various home people inside the church to see if we're such a blessing. Looking this morning at 1 Corinthians chapter 9. the singing yesterday, I didn't get time to focus on the PowerPoint. I wish I could have, because there's an outline here in these verses that I would want to put up and have called alliteration. So we're going to have some parts as we look through this, this passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Those of you who attend here regularly, you know, I've been working through the book of 1 Corinthians and messages. And the last message was on the subject of eating meat offered to idols. What did that mean to them? How do we apply that today to the application? It's a little bit of a stretch today in American culture. Some cultures in the world. How do we that and the concept is there that the meat itself was not polluted, that all foods are clean as Jesus told Peter in a vision, but in some people's conscience it was not, and so Paul concluded the discussion on it that we looked at last time by saying, if meat causes my brother to stumble, I won't be. And that leaves us with the question, so I need to be subject to someone else's conscience. How does this apply to me? I just want to be subject to what I really need to give up. Do I really need to be subject to everybody else's limits and concerns and things? So we're going to look at that some more this morning. And, because this subject of food offered to idols covers three chapters. It's a big deal to that church. And it was a big enough deal that God wanted to put in the scriptures and wanted this preserved for us today. So there's things for us to learn and things that apply to us. And in chapter 9, Paul really focuses on a certain aspect of it. Because he said, if we submit to someone else's conscience and do what they say, we have to give up our own rights to make room for their weak conscience. So Paul takes on this subject of rights, my rights. We as Americans are all about our rights. We're all, I'm talking as an overall country, not talking about you specifically. We're all about our rights, our freedoms. Freedom is a big deal to America. And it's been a core part of who we are for a long time. All the way back to when a Quaker named William Penn first got a tract of land and started renting it out to people to come live on his land in this new world. And as he set up the government for his land, he endeavored to set up a government that ensured, this is a quote from his first non-constitutional development, that he wanted to set up a government that ensured perfect freedom and uncontrolled enjoyment of all the rights and privileges of the law of nature. And this idea that there are rights and privileges that the laws of nature give to people that are guaranteed to every person was this new thing, especially as applied to government. The idea was not new originally with William Penn. It came from a man by the name of John Locke. He was an English doctor and a physician. He knew William Penn personally. He was a little older than him. But John Locke's name was a major influence on America, on the American Revolutionary. When they started, in fact, John Locke's theories come through very clearly in the Declaration of Independence through the words that Thomas Jefferson penned there. Very familiar words. We hold these truths, according to the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and rights is capitalized. Declaration. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then he goes on to say that government is for the purpose of securing those rights, and when government fails to do that, people have the right to overthrow the government and set up a new government. That's the basis for the Declaration of Independence. That's the plot this country was built on. They acknowledged the Creator, but it was simply a Creator that had given men rights, and now people were left to govern themselves. It's called deism, that God basically created the world, got everything in motion, and is now some distant force, not actively, personally involved, as we believe God is. That's what Thomas Jefferson believed in. We talk a lot about his beliefs and how they influence our country. That he was off base on. But this thinking of unalienable rights guaranteed by the laws of nature, very, very prevalent in our American mindset. And freedom is a big part of who we are. But what do we mean by freedom? What do we mean by liberty? Well, freedom, at least as I understand it, freedom is the ability to do what you want and to do what you have the power to do. I can demonstrate this with some basic freedoms that I have right now. I have the freedom, the ability to walk around. I do not have the freedom to fly like a bird. I don't have that ability. But I have the freedom to walk. I can walk over here to this side of the room if I choose to. I can walk over to that side. I have the freedom to sit down and stop talking. I'm nervous if I were to do that. I would have the freedom to go out in my van, get in the van, and drive away. I have the ability to do that. He's raising my pocket. Now, I'm sure my wife is glad that I don't actually want to drive all by myself right now. But I would have the freedom to do that. And everybody who's alive has some level of freedom, some level of choice to do what you want to do. No one has unlimited freedom. And unlimited freedom is good, but unlimited freedom is never good. Limitless freedom is never a good thing. Why? Well, because when you start taking your freedoms to extremes, at some point, as I start expressing more and more of my freedoms and doing more and more of whatever I happen to feel like doing, at some point, my freedom is going to start reducing your freedom. You take this to an extreme, it becomes obvious. If I come up to you and threaten you, I don't want any guns, but if I did, whatever, it happened. If I come to you and threaten you and demand that you give me your money, and I was threatening and mean and scary, not that they are, and you would give me your money, now I would theoretically anyway, have more freedom. I would have the power to do more things with more money. You would have less. Of course, my increased freedom would be short-lived because you'd call the police and they would end up being long away. Now, you would have more freedom again, and my freedom would be greatly reduced. So, unlimited freedom is never a good thing. Liberty, by contrast, takes into account the rights of everyone else. Liberty attempts to ensure, and this is just my understanding, some people define words differently, but liberty attempts to ensure that everyone's legitimate freedoms and everyone's rights are protected. Liberty requires someone or a group of people to decide what rights should be protected and whose rights should be protected. We call that government. And government doesn't always get it right, as in the case of slavery in early America. They decided that white people should have lots of freedoms, and interestingly, black, you have very little freedom. Or potentially, you could have very little freedom to be treated as an animal, bought and sold, and eat and be killed like an animal. But freedom essentially is the power to do what you want. Liberty is the power to do what you right now. And that's, again, it's my understanding. But that begs the question, what is right and good, and who decides what is right and what is good? Well, in America, who decides what is right and good? It is decided by the people. By the people. That's the way our government is set up, that the people decide what is right and good, in the bounds of the Constitution, but based on our people's interpretation of it. People decide what is right and good. And you can say what you want about the poor quality of the current candidates for president. I might agree with you on that. But the truth is, at least I think, they are an accurate representation of a large number of people. They have a group of followers, each side, and their views of what is right and good match the views of the people who support them, for the most part, of what is right and good. And it is a fairly accurate and sad portrayal of views of our country. And what we think of as right and good has changed over the years, dramatically, over the past 100 years. And you can see this in culture, especially in songs. Of course, I'm fascinated with songs, but if you take a look at some songs that have been popular, especially patriotic songs, over the years, we get a picture of how our view of what is right and good has changed. For instance, take the song "America the Beautiful," written in 1893. "America the Beautiful" was written by Catherine Lee Bates. She started writing the song from the top of the text, inspired by the view, and then finished it later on, over the course of a couple of days and weeks. But 1893 was a time of expansion, of growth. The West was about conquered, the country was being settled all over. As you see the top of this mountain, we saw the amber waves of grain and the purple mountains majesty in the song. She also had been to the Chicago World's Fair and had seen the section there called the White City. So much of it was painted bright white, and lit with this brand new invention called the electric streetlights. And she saw this gleaming and wrote about the hourglass of cities that gleam undimmed by human fears. Is that what our cities are like? But at the time, that's what it looked like. That things were just going to get better and better, prosperity was going to increase, and really, that's the focus of the song, prosperity. What is right and good is what leads to prosperity, and things are just going to get better and better until it turns into perfection. So as you know, human fears were not undimmed. In fact, human fears increased. The world erupted in war. And then the stock market crashed, and prosperity, everybody kind of got a little sour looking. Prosperity is the future of everything. And then the world started getting embroiled in war again. And you find another song rise in popularity in 1938. Song "God Bless America." World War II was brewing over in Europe. And songwriter, composer Irving Berlin took a song off the shelf and he'd written as a war song back in World War I and kind of put on the shelf because it didn't seem quite right. And he rewrote it and made it a song of peace. And the song "God Bless America" holds up peace and security and holds that as the idea, because that's what people wanted then. And that's what they thought was what was right and good, was what brought us as a country peace and security. Well, time went on. We had the upheaval of the 60s and everything in the 70s, what happened there, with morale being thrown out and people redefining all kinds of stuff. And everything got a lot more individualistic. It got to be more about me rather than national peace and security. And we find another patriotic song getting very popular. 1984, Lee Greenwood came out with "God Bless the USA." And instead of imagining the prosperity or the peace, in his anthem, he looks at imagining losing everything. If you know the song. And he concludes that "I would still be so thankful to be an American because of the freedom that we have," and he holds up as the ideal in that song. What is right and good is what gives us the ability to choose and to define our own destinies. In some ways, that acts as the core of what the Declaration of Independence was written for. But it was much more of an individualistic vision. It's what makes me happy. And we start to see that kind of thing more and more. There's another song that became popular. And by the way, a lot of these songs that I mentioned here are country music, and are all, these three in a row here, are all winners of the Country Music Song of the Year Award. That was 1984. 1994, the song was called "Independence Day." It was sung by Martina McBride. Sean Hannity uses the chorus of it for the theme of his radio show. And if you just hear that, "Let Freedom Ring, Let the White Dove Sing," and think kind of the same thing with Lee Greenwood. But if you look at the words of the song more in detail, it's much darker. And what it holds up as right and good is a lot darker and a lot different. Because the song tells the story of an abusive home, of an alcoholic husband who beats his wife and their 8-year-old daughter. The song is pictured in her eyes. And she watches as her mother gets bruises, and then as her mother generation burns the house down, kills her father, and possibly commits suicide. And the song holds that up as gaining independence, as gaining freedom. It doesn't exactly justify the murder and suicide, but it says maybe it's the only way. And the song holds up what is right and good as whatever is necessary to gain your freedom. Whatever is necessary to throw off your custom. And it's a portrayal of American viewpoint at the end of the 20th century. 21st century comes along. Things are changing yet again. Country Music Song of the Year for 2013, I think for 2014, the word is a song called Follow Your Arrow. Saw a singer named Casey Musgrave. The song, I would not recommend listening to it. It has some offensive content, I think. But it sadly paints a picture of what Americans view as right and wrong. What is wrong is defined in this by whatever feels right to you, the individual. The song starts with the problem, which is a truth, that you can't please everybody. But the conclusion that it comes to is, since you can't please everybody, you might as well just do what you want. And I think the song says that in those words. The bridge to the song is, say what you say, love who you love, because you only get so many trips around the sun, you only live once. But doesn't that sound a lot like what Isaiah said? Isaiah 22. Jerusalem, first of all, Jerusalem will have to be destroyed. And God gives one last plea to the people, who says Isaiah 22:12, in that day the Lord God of hosts called for weeping and mourning. Your country is going to be destroyed. The end is near. Repent. I call for weeping and mourning, for baldness and wearing sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, killing oxen and slaughtering sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. And Jesus predicted it too, as in the days of Noah, eating and drinking, marrying between parents, so in the days of the Son of Man. But that's what our country thinks is right and wrong, and that's what defines freedom and liberty in this country today. And then in contrast to the ever-changing views of right and wrong of our culture, the Word of God is unchanging, and it's just as relevant to life as it was when we went to verse 10. We saw well take on the phrase, all things are lawful for me, in the last message. We also saw him say, if what I eat causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat until the world stands. So are we as Christians supposed to lay down every inch of our personal rights and be controlled by the whims and oversensitive conscience of others? Don't I need to stand up for my rights? Paul anticipates these questions, and in writing to the Church of Corinth, with no concern at all for his own reputation, with no concern at all for holding nothing back as far as trying to protect himself, he lays himself on the table as an example of how we are to handle our rights. So let's look at this, at how we're to handle our rights. And we have four R's in this. We have our rights. We have rights. We have a right to recognize. We have rights restrained. We'll have rights redirected, and then our rights diluted. So recognize, restrain, redirect, and then diluted. So first, we recognize his rights, and that's in 1 Corinthians 9, chapter 1. Well, let's read that. Paul says this. Am I not free? Yeah, we're talking about freedom. Right? Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my workmanship, Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take on the leading light of the other apostles and the brother of the Lord? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no legs to refrain from working for him? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Or who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an oxen when it treads out the grain. Is it the oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. We have some spiritual things from you. Too much of the material things from you. If others share this right to pay from you, do not need even more. So you say other people's scruples, their consciences are trampling on your rights. What about me, Paul says? What about my rights? I have the credentials, he says. I'm an apostle. I've seen Jesus personally. Now, he may or may not have seen Jesus personally. The Bible doesn't speak to us on that account. But we know that he saw Jesus along the road to Damascus in a vision there. And Paul made much of that. That was his calling as an apostle. But in the disciples, he says, you, the church of Corinth, if to nobody else in the world I'm an apostle, at least I am. So he has the credentials, and then he lists some of his rights. Don't we have, and he says them in questions with obvious and quiet answers. Don't we have the right to eat and drink before the Lord? Don't we have the right to take a long and believing life? You know, he talks also in the book of 1 Corinthians about how having a wife, having a family, divides a man's attention. And there's a sense in where a person can give themselves wholly to service to the Lord, simply that they can't when they're married. But there's a lot of comfort and a lot of strength and a lot of joy that comes with being married when you have a wife. And while you don't have the right to do that, of course you would. But if you chose not to, do I have the right to earn a living from preaching? You know, I feel almost subconscious even reading these verses about the need for a church to support its ministry financially. And here was Paul saying this unashamedly, that I have this right, and he uses that, which is something that most men would be ashamed to bring up. He uses that as an example of rights and how our attitude toward our rights should be. Those were his rights. What about my rights personally? The Declaration of Independence says I have the right to life, to liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we can think about what Jesus said about the person who wants to save their life. He saves his life for the sake of his life for my sake of the gospel. And in terms of the right to life, the right that the Declaration of Independence the right to liberty. We have Paul saying all things are lawful for me, but not all things are excuses, not all things are lawful. What about the right to the pursuit of happiness? This is a little bit of an aside, but I read a book recently, or part of a book, titled Boundaries in Marriage by Henry Cloud and John Templeton. And happiness, pursuing happiness, listen to what Henry Cloud says on happiness. He says, I can't think of a worse value in life. Happiness calls it the worst value ever. People who always want to be happy and pursue it above all else are some of the most miserable people in the world. You want to be happy? You pursue happiness. This is the set of people who pursue happiness and want that above all else are some of the most miserable people in the world. The reason is that happiness is a result. Going again, if happiness is our guide and it goes away voluntarily, we will see that something is wrong. The truth is, and this is why happiness is such a powerful value, that when we are not happy, something good may be happening. You may have been brought to that moment of crisis because of the need to grow, and that crisis may be the solution to much of what is wrong with your life. If you could grasp whatever it is that this situation is asking you to learn, it could change your life. This is how James tells us to count it all joy when you face trials and great times. uses his example as the rights of a minister to be supported, to be paid for his work in the gospel, as an example of how we should have an attitude for our rights. So he recognizes his rights. I have the right to earn a living from the gospel. What is his attitude for that right? Does he make use of it? Does he defend it? He defends it in principle. But then he says, and let's continue reading. This is rights restrained, second part. Verse 12, continue. Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right. But we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offering? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision. For I would rather die than anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting. For necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have no reward. But if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with his stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my rights in the gospel. What was Paul's attitude toward his own rights? Rather than standing up for his rights and defending them, he says, we endure anything rather than, what do we value more highly than his rights? Rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He saw things in perspective. His own importance, his own rights were minuscule in comparison to the importance of the gospel of Jesus Christ. His own authority as a leader in the church was of infinitely lesser importance than the authority of Jesus Christ. And his authority was completely subject, completely under the authority of Jesus Christ. He saw that structure of God's authority. I have authority because I am under authority. Much like the centurion who asked Jesus to heal his servant and then said, you don't need to come to speak the word because I'm a man under authority and I have men in authority under me. And I say to my servant, go and get my servant. Jesus knew this and said, I haven't seen faith like this in all of this world. Because this man knew that Jesus had authority over things like diseases, even from a distance, because Jesus was himself under the authority of the God who created and controlled the entire universe. And he understood that authority structure. Paul understood it in exactly the same way. And he completely subjected his rights as well to the authority of his master. And as he laid aside his rights, as he restrained his rights, he wasn't meekly hanging in his hand while others trampled on him. Rather, he was boldly standing, faithfully, loyally under authority, far higher than his own. Can we say with Paul that we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Will you endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Challenge. And Paul gives us a second reason for restraining his rights. And this sounds far less noble than the first reason. And yet he uses even stronger language. He says, I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. Why isn't boasting evil? I had to think of what Jesus said in Luke 17, 7 through 10. Will any of you who has a servant plowing? And give the sheep, say to him when he is coming, he will come in at once and recline at the table. Will he not rather say to him, prepare supper for me, and dress properly, and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterwards you can eat? Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? And why answers no. He simply did what he was commanded to do. And then Jesus said this, so you also, when you have done all that you were commanded, say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done what we are doing. And that is the attitude that Paul has towards the ministry in the gospel. He says, says, if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. It has been commanded to me. It is my charge by my master. I'm in big trouble if I don't preach the gospel. So there's no grounds for boasting in that. And we preachers, and I'm speaking for myself here, I think there's probably a lot of other preachers that would tend toward the same mindset. But I like to think that I deserve to be praised for what I do. For preaching. I look at my preaching and my time as a sacrifice. As I'm given a lot, I deserve to be rewarded for it. Just being honest here. Is that an accurate way to do what I do? It certainly is not how Paul views his ministry. And my calling has been far less dramatic and far less huge than the call of Paul has given. I've been given a stewardship. I've been commanded to preach the gospel. Therefore, I'm not remaining the words by preaching. I'm merely doing what I've been commanded to do. Woe is me if I preach not the gospel. So should we not desire to be rewarded? Paul certainly desired to be rewarded, to have his words approved. He was not ashamed of that desire. He says, what is my reward? That in preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as to not make full use of my right in the gospel. And here is a truth that is worth noting. Looking at your personal rights, unused rights earn rewards. Unused rights earn rewards. You have the right to something, and if you defer that right, that is a way of earning rewards. That's exactly what Paul said. I defer my right to be supported so that I can gain this reward. We can make full use of our rights. We can demand that we get our fair share, that we can take great pains to ensure that our work is rewarded to get our due. But like Jesus said to those who did their deeds in front of him, he said they have their reward. If you demand that your rights are kept and you get what you deserve, you have your reward. Paul says, I'm not going to settle for that. I'm going for a much, much greater reward. So I'm going to defer my rights. I'm going to restrain my rights. And then, see, thirdly, his rights redirected. Rather than standing up for his rights and making full use of them, Paul redirects his spirit. And it is here that we see the power of living in this man. Let's read. Continue reading in chapter 19. For though I am free from all, Paul says, I have made myself a servant to all, that I may win more of them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, but not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with you in its blessings. Paul redirects his freedom. Instead of standing up for his rights, he says, I become the servant of all. And the power of what he's saying here is a little bit lost when we use the word servant. Not because it's a bad translation, but because we don't have servants like they did back then. Especially in Paul's day. Their servants were closer to what we would call a slave. They were completely committed to serve their master, somewhat for a time period, what we would call an indentured servant back in the day, I think colonial America, and somewhat for life, what we would call a slave. But they were more akin to property than they were to employees. Paul says, I make myself the slave of everyone. But how did he make himself their slave? Did he do their laundry? Did he scrub their floors? Water their horses? Now, he didn't make himself their slave by working for them, but he was not first physical labor. He provided for him, Barnabas provided for themselves and worked with their hands to earn their own support. But he made himself their slave, not physically, but on the level of conscience. He He says, I became all things to all men. I took on their scruples. What their conscience says was right. Even though I knew much more than they did. Even though they were not enlightened yet to the freedom that they had, the full freedom that they had in Christ, I became like them to win them. What did it actually look like for him to be their slave? He says, to the Jews, I became as a Jew. To those under the law, I became as those under the law. And so when he was ministering, when he was reaching out to the Jews, he took on their, he honored their consciences and took on that as his rule and way of life. So we see him in Acts 18, it says that he shaved his head in Gentry because he had a vow. We also see him in Jerusalem, just before he was captured by the Jews. He was almost killed there in Jerusalem. We see him again shaving his head. It was the Old Testament law. It was the Nazarite vow that a man would take. A man would commit himself to the Lord, usually for a period of time. And during that time, he would not drink wine. He would not cut his hair. Now, you're more familiar with the lifers in this Nazarite vow system, like Samson or Samuel, that for life would never drink wine, never cut their hair. But usually, people who put themselves under a vow were termed Nazarites. They would say, for the next year, I'm going to give myself wholeheartedly to the Lord. And at the time, they did not get their hair. When the time was up, they would go to the temple. You can read about this in the Law of Moses if you want to. They would go to the temple, bring an offering that was expensive to them, and they would cut their hair. And this hair was part of the offering. It was a big deal. And so when Paul goes to Jerusalem to bring the gift, the offering that he collects from the churches in Corinth, and he comes to bring this offering and minister to the Jews, the leaders say, there's people here that are okay with what you're doing to be with the Gentiles. And so, to honor their consciences, to prove that you keep the law, we have these four men here who are under vow. You go with them, you shave your head with them, and you pay their expenses. This wasn't only acting the part, this cost him real money. And he worked to earn his money. This was a big deal. And he did it. When he was ministering to the Jews there in Jerusalem, he became as a Jew, as one under the law, and he might reach them. And we know that didn't end well. Some of the Jews turned against him anyway, and he was imprisoned there. But to those under the law, he became as those under the law. Also, to those outside the law, he became as those outside the law. And we see a really striking story of this in the book of Galatians. The set of the church Antioch, Paul was ministering in Antioch along with Barnabas, and Peter was there at the time. And there, far back from Jerusalem, he sees the church was put on the Gentiles. They were those outside the law, and so Paul became as one outside the law. Not that he violated God's law, he would never do that, but he ate and drank with the Gentiles, he ate their food, and associated completely with them. As did Barnabas and Peter. That made sense. Peter was the one who first took the gospel to the Gentiles. Barnabas was with Paul on that first mission trip for the gospel. It was really spread to the Gentiles. And then something happened. Some men came from Jerusalem. Jewish Christians. Men who were closely connected to James, who was the most powerful person in the Christian church at the time. And out of fear of these Jewish men, now you have a Gentile church. So we're reaching out to those who are outside the law. And you have people who are under the law coming in. And what did the Jewish Christians in the church do? Including Peter and Barnabas. They went over to the other side. They started acting as one under the law and were still trying to minister to those people outside the law. What did Paul do? He put his own self completely on the line, his entire ministry on the line, and stood up publicly with the Gentiles and publicly rebuked Peter for what he was doing. Because in that setting, they were reaching those outside the law. And he says, you're taking the fear of men, the fear of James in Jerusalem, above, fear of what James might think, above the souls of these people, these brothers in the church. And you're offending their souls. And he has been to reach those outside the law, and he's one outside the law. And then he says, to the weak, I became weak. that I've been doing. And this, according to one commentator, is the climax of Paul's argument in this chapter. This is what Paul's been building up to the weak I became weak. Who were the weak? The weak were those whose consciences were not enlightened, who didn't know the full truth of the gospel, and specifically in this setting, the weak were those who were afraid of idols and thought they could not eat meat because it may have been offered to idols. And that was the issue that they were dealing with. And Paul says, to the weak, I became as weak. I laid out my right to eat and drink, to eat this meat, who knows, would be so good, that I might live the weak. I laid down my own rights and became subject to the consciences of others. Paul never lost his respect or his position in Christ or the freedom that he had. But when his master said, serve these people, he became their slave, not only his outward actions, but he became obedient to the directives of their consciences. I have become all things. Notice how he uses the word all. It's a beautiful play on words. I have become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. Anything he knew that a lot of the people that he ministered to, that he shared the gospel to, would not receive it. They would not come to Jesus for their salvation. But Paul was not seeking after response percentages or overall numbers. He was seeking the souls of men and women. He was seeking the souls of people. And he said, I will do anything, whatever it takes, to save some. I have become all things to all men, that by all means I may save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them its blessings. What is this freedom Paul values above all else? What is the thing that Paul values above all else? It is the gospel. I do it all for the sake of the gospel. Notice the high value that he places on the souls of men. Do I value the souls of men like that? Is that my life will testify to that? I pray that God will forgive me for my fearfulness. God will soften my heart. Light is fire in my soul so that it will burn in the souls of others. A few more verses yet in this chapter we want to look at quickly. Freedom of the Lord. Verses 9, verses 20, verses 27. Do you not know that all in a race, that in a race all run is on, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box with one beating in the air, but I discipline my body and put it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. So Paul valued the souls of men and the gospel so highly that he says, I would do anything for that. How did he maintain that level of intensity? How did he maintain that level of love for the souls of people? Did it just come naturally? Was his calling and vision so strong that he just couldn't help it? We see in the final verse of this chapter that he was not doing what came naturally. He was not doing what was effortless. He likened his approach to the gospel, to keeping himself conditioned in that love for the gospel, love for the souls of people. He likened that to an athlete conditioning himself for a race. And this isn't a weekend baseball player or a track and field day for fun. This is an Olympic level runner he's talking about. You've probably seen Olympic level runners recently. But when someone goes out there to run one of those races, take the person who wins, the person who comes away with the gold medal. What attitude do you think they go into that race with? They are there to win. They are there to win. And they don't just have that attitude on the day of the race. They have had that attitude for years and years. They have been training and training for that moment, knowing that only one person is going to win. Rick Rhodes, when he was here, shared on this much more powerfully than I can in much more depth. But that is the attitude that we're supposed to have toward the gospel, toward our presenting the gospel to the people around us. We train at the level that athlete would. Like, that's the level of intensity and work that put into it. Self-discipline, self-control. Self-control being temporarily withholding pleasure from ourselves for the purpose of experiencing greater pleasure in the future. Self-control could also be described as delayed gratification. I refrain from indulging in the thing that I would enjoy now because there's going to be something else that I'm going to enjoy a lot more later. I can have a little fun now, but I can have a much, much bigger reward later. So I set aside what will feel good now and go for the bigger later reward. That's self-control. What's self-discipline? The translation I read says, I discipline my body and keep it under control. So the 1984 NIV says, I beat my body and make it my slave. I cause myself physical pain. I pummel my body into submission. That's pretty strong. And yet, if you think about it, for an athlete, I don't know how right to train. I saw it when I was teenager, so my friends got into bodybuilding a little bit, and I heard it explained several times how you lift those weights and you take your muscles right to the limit, and then just a little pat so it takes care, just a little bit, not too much, you manage yourself, but just a little bit, and then it grows back stronger and stronger, and you cause just the right level of pain so that you build. And I think a lot of athletic training is the same way. That is the attitude that Paul had to himself. I beat my body and make it my slave. And then end with a somber warning to me and to all of us. Thus, after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. It's a very real possibility for someone to successfully preach the gospel to others. And yet, because of personal self, lack of self-control, in the end, be a castaway, in the end, fall away. And we've seen many men do this. Great leaders who were either deceived by the logic of men who drawn away from the truth of God, or who failed to control their own physical lusts and gave themselves over to sinful behaviors. Paul gives a somber warning for that. As after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. And he strengthens it a few verses on in chapter 10. Therefore, let him that stand less than Paul. If you think you stand, take heed lest you fall. So how do we view our rights? Well, we recognize them, this interview as we close. We recognize them, and we restrain them. We don't make full use of our rights, like Paul did. We redirect them, and instead of standing up for our own rights, we become a servant of others. And we live for that reward, for that greater reward. Are you going to follow your arrow wherever it points and discipline your body or keep it under control? Will you run so as to win the prize? Will you lay down the rights and give everything to the furthest of the gospel and the salvation of sinners? Thank you so much for your work and the challenge to call to self-discipline and self-control and to give everything. Those we come in contact with, and those who give us influence.